This is another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. There's more at allbook-books.com. So this could be a many-part series, but I'm not sure how in-depth I'm going to get into it. But I got a ton out of this book, and I'll preface it by saying that before I read Eduardo Galeano's Open Veins of Latin America, I had felt like this heart energy, like my heart just said, I have to read this book, and that proved true. And most of the time, I just have an interest in a book. Oh, that looks interesting or sounds interesting, and there's some, you know, more reason to read it. But this particular book, because of the nature of it, the psychology of it, I just had this sense that it was going to help me personally with unraveling some old patterns or beliefs or thoughts or whatever. And it delivered. So that's the personal angle of it, but yet there's a beyond the personal experience of it. It's I found it an excellent book from 1956 by Juste A.M. Mirlu, M.D. The Rape of the Mind, The Psychology of Thought Control, Menticide, and Brainwashing. And he escaped the Nazis and changed his first name was Abraham. So for the obvious reason, so he could facilitate his escape, he changed it to a Nordic-sounding name, Juste, J-O-O-S-T. And this book showed me how much I like and appreciate psychology and what motivates people. So that's been a recurring theme in my studies and my writings for many years, is that whole sense of why do people go along with things that have negative attributes or effects, and yet they believe that it is the right way or the true, that it's justice and yada yada. I first heard of this book by listening to Matthias Desmet, whose work I enjoy a lot. I appreciate his articles at Substack. I find him to be very clear thinking and puts a good angle on interpreting what's going on. And I reviewed his book a while ago, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, because he talks about what's called mass formation and what it is that makes people go along with stuff. Thus, the title, again, the subtitle, Psychology of Thought Control, Menticide, and Brainwashing, because something has to happen for people to go along with something such as Stalin or Hitler, or now is where it gets challenging to kind of convey this information to some people, that the some of the U.S. History and ongoing history, of which I will read some quotes to show that. But first off, I want to say in the beginning of the book, in the foreword, he gives the word root of rape, because, I mean, nowadays people think of rape as the physical sexual kind, but the word rape is derived from the Latin word rapere, R-A-P-E-R-E, to snatch, but also is related to the words to rave and raven. It means to overwhelm and to enrapture, to invade, to usurp, to pillage, and to steal. Now, this reminded me of the language used in the so-called Doctrine of Christian Discovery. This is from Pope Nicholas V, issued the papal bull Dum Diversus on June 18th, 1452. It authorized Alfonso V of Portugal to reduce any Saracens, Muslims, and pagans, and any other unbelievers to perpetual slavery. This is what facilitated the slave trade and also is the underlying principle of the federal anti-Indian law, as I've heard it referred to by Peter D'Errico and with the work of Stephen Newcomb. His excellent book, Pagans in the Promised Land. So the language is to invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever, and other enemies of Christ. So here's the word rape, saying to invade, to usurp, to pillage, and to steal. So linguistically, quite the similarity, because people's minds had to be brainwashed to consider that in one particular case, the people of Turtle Island, because they were not Christians, that justified the taking of the land and other ensuing atrocities. So that's one of the premises of the book, which is excellently written. One friend who actually grew up in the Soviet Union said, you know, he found it, the book, somewhat, you know, it was sort of more familiar to him. So maybe, obviously, any book is subjective, and it's 1956, so some of it may be, I haven't studied this topic a lot, so some of it may be behind the time, so to speak, but I personally found it highly informative and enlightening in many, many ways. And I'll also say that the only flaw, it's excellently written, but a major flaw is, and perhaps due to the fact that it's 1956, is repeated references to primitive when talking about what would be native or indigenous peoples, primitive views, and he has a very sort of negative view, which my guess is it comes from the lack of any research at that time, and then not actually talking to the native peoples, which is not uncommon in research and science. So, yeah, well, that's disturbing. But overall, if you're going to look past that, then the book has a lot of insightful stuff into it. I think also the Mirlu did not understand the sense of, like with the Haudenosaunee, one of their, in some of their gatherings, they have like unanimous decisions and we are of one mind kind of thing. But Mirlu kind of considers that kind of sense of unity. I don't think he kind of gets what that is. It's more of a, he's more of a speaking for the individual's free thinking, which has its place, but in the context of communal living, I'm not sure he gets that. But other than that, there's so much in this book that I could make it an umpteen part series. A few of the things that jumped out at me were the sense of the tactics used, which are still being used today, you know, fear, Pavlovian conditioning, you know, everything from the global war of terror, the way the pandemic was presented. These are all fear tactics used to sway people and get them out of their normal thinking. So in effect, a thought control and menticide, if people like lose it because of those. Many of the tactics, like slogans that are repeated over and over and over again, these are also used in advertising. Some of the positives of that he cites, inner strength, having some cause, or, you know, could be family or friends or certain people that got through the difficult times, which in the book is more specifically the interrogations and sometimes torture of prisoners in war scenarios, whether it was in Korea or, you know, with Hitler. So there's obviously a serious strain to the references. It's not just intellectualizing. And this guy, the author Mirlu, he dealt with that some of that personally, so it's coming from firsthand experience, and he interviewed people. But again, it's the thing about what makes people conform and give up their free thinking. He also refers to it highlights the word infantile and how people are often seeking, whether it's the comfort zone of you know, that infantile experience, or whether something that somebody did not get as a child then becomes played out, you know, power tripping and controlling. If people felt they couldn't control things when they were little, and then it's like this ability to control freak in serious geopolitical, psychological venues. So there's all kinds of psychological reasons and examples given. So now I want to jump to the part of why I wanted to read this, because also, it makes me wonder about what the disconnect is for people with the U.S., because the U.S. has its track record of the history built on slavery and genocidal activity toward the native peoples, yet people overlook that. And so here is, first is a quote from a John Pilger, an esteemed journalist, well-respected, been doing it for, I don't know, 50-something years. He's also a filmmaker. Of all the journalists I've read in the past 20-something years, he is just one of the tops as far as honest, compassionate. He's got his information. He can back it up in a compassionate way. And just an excellent writer, and on and on. So here he writes in his recent essay, in his recent article, Silencing the Lambs, How Propaganda Works. In my lifetime, the United States has overthrown or attempted to overthrow more than 50 governments, mostly democracies. It has interfered in democratic elections in 30 countries. It has dropped bombs on the people of 30 countries, most of them poor and defenseless. It has attempted to murder the leaders of 50 countries. It has fought to suppress liberation movements in 20 countries. Now, how does one reconcile a, quote, democracy going around the world and suppressing liberation movements in 20 countries? And then further on, he quotes Harold Pinter, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And Pinter said, "The crimes of the United States have been systematic, constant, vicious, remorseless, but very few people have actually talked about them. You have to hand it to America. It has exercised a quite clinical manipulation of power worldwide while masquerading as a force for universal good. It is a brilliant, even witty, highly successful act of hypnosis." So that's powerful language there. But again, the hypnosis is befitting of the book, Psychology of Thought Control, Brainwashing. And then another article I saw this week, another respected journalist, younger guy, Ben Norton. The headline, again, disturbing, challenging stuff. If you've never heard this, U.S. post-9/11 wars caused 4.5 million deaths and displaced 38 to 60 million people. The wars of the U.S. waged and fueled in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan following September 11, 2001 caused at least 4.5 million deaths, according to a report by Brown University. Nearly a million of the people who lost their lives died in fighting, whereas some 3.6 to 3.7 million were indirect deaths due to health and economic problems caused by the wars, such as diseases, malnutrition, and destruction of infrastructure. U.S. drone strikes in Yemen and Somalia significantly impact people's livelihood sources, killing workers, destroying farms and businesses, and bankrupting families. Now, this is just so sad. I read this, and if I was not in this mode of doing a presentation here, I could just bust out crying, because it's just so sad and horrific. And so I am just left with, like, how do people not connect the dots? But that's not for me to figure it out. But this book, that's part of why I wanted to read this book, is like, what happens that has people, you know, seeing one thing. I think in some degrees it's selectiveness, that there's a selective viewing kind of thing. Another quote, you know, quote in the book I highlighted, "No brainwashing is possible without totalitarian thinking." So as with the papal bulls, if people can be convinced that someone else is a subhuman or less than human or does not belong, once a certain screw is turned, like if you can, because that's the dominant theme, you know, in Vietnam, the Vietnamese were gooks. If you can convince the people fighting the war that those are the enemies and those are gooks, then you can unfold any kind of atrocity, because it is in the name of justice and liberty and democracy. But if you consider the Vietnamese as fellow human beings, then that kind of thinking changes the whole scenario. Another thing I learned too is that he said, like, one of the tactics of Hitler was just like illogical behavior, random and kind of really whack illogical behavior, which if you're like a clear thinking person or you think things through, that's hard to deal with. So, you know, sometimes I find it challenging when, you know, it's like, wow, how do you respond to something that just seems so out there? but that is also a tactic to throw one off balance. And even that's the famous quote that Karl Rove, Bush's brain, said some years ago about, I'm just doing it by memory, you know, we are history's maker, we rewrite history, and it's your job to follow us. He's basically was saying a similar thing about, we're not going to be logical and we're going to do crazy stuff, and you're just going to have to try to catch up with us, which is to keep the populace, you know, off balance. And that is one way of confusing people and hence brainwashing them. One of the positive notes is he said that even though it could take some therapy, the author Mirlu says, even though it could take some therapy or time, that once people were out of the scenarios, like after the war or something like that, once they had even a taste of fresh air, a taste of true being able to be free, and that once they just had a taste of it, that they could recover and come back to their, you know, true thinking ways. So that was a promising note. Obviously, it depends on the people. Some people are scarred or have, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder for a lifetime. So all these things depend on the individual, but yet there are common themes. And here's just one little bit. And a lot of this book, a lot of Mirlu's book, when he talks about technology, it's like it was written yesterday. But here's a bit, I'll just quote, something has crept into our mechanized system of communication that has made our modes of thinking deteriorate. People, too, casually acquire ideas and concepts. They no longer struggle for a clear understanding. The popularized picture replaces the battle of the pros and cons of concepts. Instead of aiming at true understanding, people listen to thoughtless repetition, which gives them the delusion of understanding. Communication has an even more infantile magic character for the citizen of totalitaria. Words no longer represent intelligible meanings or ideas. They bind the citizen of totalitaria to utter dependence on his commander, much as the infant is bound to the words, to the word pictures of his parents. Now, if that doesn't describe a lot of the social media and the news today that's sanitized and controlled by the tech companies, and the people that eat that up, people too casually acquire ideas and concepts. They no longer struggle for a clear understanding. The popularized picture replaces the battle of the pros and cons of concepts. Instead of aiming at true understanding, people listen to thoughtless repetition, which gives them the delusion of understanding. That's been shown umpteen times with video edited clips from local news to CNN and other major news outlets repeating the same lines. Now, where did they get those lines from? So there are many questions, and I'll probably do at least one more to talk more about the book specifically and some highlights from the book. But in Pilger's article, I found it is also fascinating because he addresses what I sometimes think, like people are always pointing the finger at the, you know, the one percenters and, you know, the billionaires and various politics and people doing nasty stuff, which has its place. But I personally feel like there's a lack of pointing the finger at the people themselves. I point the finger at myself so I can learn and adapt. But I think that oftentimes the finger, you know, we pass the buck on to the powers that be instead of looking at ourselves in the mirror. So Pilger's article begins, in the 1970s, I met one of Hitler's leading propagandists, Leni Riefenstahl, whose epic films glorified the Nazis. We happened to be staying at the same lodge in Kenya where she was on a photography assignment, having escaped the fate of other friends of the Führer. She told me that the, quote, patriotic messages, unquote, of her films were dependent not on, quote, orders from above, unquote, but on what she called the, quote, submissive void, end quote, of the German public. Did that include the liberal, educated bourgeois, I asked? Yes, especially them, she said. I think of this as I look around at the propaganda now consuming Western societies. Of course, we are very different from Germany in the 1930s. We live in information societies. We are globalists. We have never been more aware, more in touch, and better connected. Are we? Or do we live in a media society where brainwashing is insidious and relentless, and perception is filtered according to the needs and lies of state and corporate power? The United States dominates the Western world's media. All but one of the top 10 media companies is based in North America. The internet and social media, Google, Twitter, Facebook, are mostly American-owned and controlled. So there's John Pilger addressing almost exactly what I got out of the book from 1956. So the tactics, that's another reason I wanted to read the book, because to learn from the tactics, because they are still being employed. And to wrap it up, I'm going to go back to the foreword. That makes sense. The foreword to the book, the preface actually, How the Mind Defends Itself. And this was written by John Paul Leonard. This was based on an interview from 2009. He mentions you never hear about it, but Pavlov actually discovered two kinds of conditioning, the repetitive and the traumatic. I did not know that. Most people are familiar with Pavlov's ringing of the bell, which, if you think about how excited you get when your little gadget goes bing-a-ding-a-dink, and you go like, oh, somebody's gonna contact me, maybe it's another friend. That is in part Pavlovian conditioning, so that you are hooked to check your email and check your text message. But anyway, the repetitive and the traumatic, I did not know. So if you read the news, which most people do, but if you get too hooked emotionally into the news, the trauma will affect you, and you will become even more Pavlovian, because that's what the news does. The media, corporate media, pumps out trauma. Not that there isn't trauma, but they pump it out. They accentuate it. And then he also mentions the brainwashing techniques of the Chinese communists on our POWs in Korea, the demagoguery of the McCarthy era, and the mass indoctrination of our high-tech consumer society with its TV, cars, and sleeping pills. Against all four systems, he advocates mental independence, faith in the individual. Dr. Mirlu says the best defense against giving in to coercion is to know what principles they are trying to use and to outwit them. Resisting is not about heroism or willpower or logic. They can break that down. For instance, one good trick is to pretend to be mad and to confess to far more and far more absurd things than one is accused of, turning the tables on the interrogator. One of my guiding mantras is from John Trudell. He said, we have to outthink them. So also from the preface, they play on the human herd instinct, the fear of ridicule for being different. Life in the U.S. itself is drenched with unobtrusive coercion. Mass media makes us passive. Public opinion is engineered. The velvet glove is more effective than Nazi or Soviet coercion because the victims don't feel it. I'll read that again, because that echoes Sheldon Wolin's inverted totalitarianism. The velvet glove is more effective than Nazi or Soviet coercion because the victims don't feel it. They get people going around brainwashing each other on their own time. And a little bit more at the end of this preface. Education based on memorizing facts and quiz scores also leads to mental passivity. Now, this is part of why I titled it Escaping the Submissive Void, from Pilger's article. Mirlu distinguishes quantilectuals, who absorb masses of facts, and quintellectuals, who really think over new ideas and make them their own. Technology robs us of our identity by making life too easy and also too busy. Is it our tool or our master? Both communism and capitalism are forms of materialism, which dulls the spirit. Bureaucracy also is a form of tyranny in all societies. To sum it up, inner-directed personalities have much better odds of resisting than those who take their cues externally, like wind vanes. The ancient Greek answer was short and sweet: know thyself. And to take that Greek phrase one step further, know thyself as interconnected with the earth and the water and the wind and the fire beings and all all manner of beings. So that's enough to chew on for now. So thank you for maybe taking a bite, and thanks for listening. Be well.